I'm Phil C.
And I'm Lynn.
And together,
we're Roman Oz.
Real interviews.
With real people.
On location.
With a great mix of Aussie music.
As requested by the people we interview.
Follow us on Facebook.
Or check us out, romanoz.com.au.
So, Phil, what's on the show this week?
Well, Lynn, do you remember last week you chatted with Dawn from Cutting Horse Farmstead.
Yes, that's correct. Just out of Tamworth.
Well, I'm actually chatting with Diane this week.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Now, Diane is actually a solo traveller, a female, travelling by herself. She's been travelling now for about 2 years.
Good on her.
In her motorhome. So I'll be chatting with her first up.
Oh, okay. And then we're going to Goorambat, which is in Northern Victoria, and you're going to be chatting to Alan Saunders about the silo art there.
Well, that's right. Now, Alan's a volunteer and he sells all this fabulous merchandise depicting some of the stuff there, the silo art.
Yes.
And straight after that, now I've got something really, really special for you, Lynn, okay?
What's that?
Well, you're going to be chatting with Wendy Killeen.
Oh, okay. It's Stanton Killeen Winery is my favourite.
Stanton Killeen Winery. And I know how much you love wine.
Yes, I do.
And you're going to be chatting with her.
Yes, that's correct.
All right. And as well as this, of course, a fabulous selection of music. As requested by the people we interview.
Well, Phil.
Yes.
For a change.
Right.
How about you play a song for me?
Look, as long as it's Aussie, Lynn, it has to be Aussie.
Of course it is.
I know you got some favourite Aussie artists.
I do.
What would you like me to play for you?
Oh, look. What about Old Black Eyes? John English.
Oh, Black Eyes.
Yes, and Hollywood 7.
All right, okay.
How's that? We never get John English played.
We don't get very, very many requests for
John English. No, it's always Slim and John Williamson and...
Well, the show is called Roaming Oz.
Yes, I know, but it's Aussie.
Having said that, John, in his heyday, did travel a lot of Australia performing around the hotels and pubs and clubs and so on and so forth. So if that's what you'd like to do, before we start the show, Lynn, I will get straight up for you right now, Hollywood 7 by John English.
Well, Phil,
on with the show.
Sleep on trains. Took the bus to Hollywood, looking for a room in the pouring rain. With hair so blonde and eyes so brown, she thought she'd take this town and turn it upside down. And me, I was living hotel just off Sunset. She moved in across the hall. And she said she'd be a movie star and waited every morning for a call. So I asked her in just to have a little drink, but she hardly had the time. I called my con tomorrow. She got to learn. Went by without a job. The money that she saved was nearly spent. And so she started bringing strangers home, just trying to find a way to pay the rent. And she'd sit down and drink my coffee. Got nothing much to say. Just busy rehearsing in her mind the scene she never played. On Hollywood 7 rooms to rent till in the end goes up in lights. Oh, Hollywood 7, dream your dreams, $7 a night.
Thank you.
she didn't come for coffee when I called. She got and brought the wrong one home this time. They were crazy lipstick marks all over the wall. Now she's going back to Omaha, but not the way she planned. There'll be no crowd to cheer her up, no welcome home, no band. On Hollywood, seven rooms to rent till your name goes up in lights. Hollywood, seven dreamy dream, $7 a night. She came in one night from Syracuse, tired from sleeping on. To Hollywood, dreaming of the lights that would spell her name. So I watched her take lease on the empty room across the hall, waking up every morning, waiting for that call.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back. I'm Phil C, and this is Roaming Oz, and we are at the Sunrise Cutting Horse Farm, which is about 10 minutes east of Tamworth, and I'm chatting with Diane, who is a full-time traveller on the road. How are you this afternoon, Diane?
I'm good, thank you.
Thank you so much for taking some time to chat with us. I was really intrigued, firstly, by your rig. Now, you've got a transit van. Tell us a little bit about your van, how you've got it set up and so on.
Well, it's a 2012 transit.
Right. Yep.
It has a double bed at the back, uh-huh. A small kitchen unit. I have an angle fridge. I do have a port-a-loo for if I need to.
Mm-hmm.
And my son has put two solars on the top, and so I've got two batteries.
Right.
And he also put, as you can see, the long tube, black tube,
yes, which
is
that.
Full of water. Well,
right.
That's my outdoor shower.
Okay.
So no matter where I am, you know, especially if I go to the beach or anything like that, or,
mm-hmm.
if, you know, the puppy gets too much sand, then mm-hmm. I can just, you know, put the hose onto it. And, yeah, it's usually, because it's black, it's usually...
Quite warm.
It's fairly warm. It's
yep.
not, you know,
yes.
hot, but it's fairly warm. And
okay.
It's been a really good addition. The first year I didn't have it, and so I used to have to, you know, go into caravan parks and that more often. But now that I've got that,
mm-hmm.
I simply just put up my little change tent at the back.
Yes.
With the doors open, secure it to the sides. And I'm set.
You got a shower wherever
yeah.
you go. Now, you've been travelling full-time. How long have you been on the road?
I've been on the road on and off. I travelled for about 2 to 2.5 years full-time
right.
when I retired.
Uh-huh.
I would go back to... I originally come from Wollongong, and so I would go back to Wollongong, you know, every 3 to 4 months and catch up with my boys. But mainly I was on the road the whole time.
Okay.
And then, of course, with COVID, you know, things changed a little bit. And so I've got a base now at my brother's place, which I have a 1978 renovated 24-foot caravan
okay.
on the property.
Right.
And so that's my base.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you venture out from there.
Yeah.
So where have you actually been on some of your trips? Well, you've been on the road for 2.5 years. So where have you been? How much of Oz have you seen?
I've been to Queensland only up as far as Noosa. I find that I really don't cope with the heat.
And
so Queensland's really hot for me. But I've been up to past Noosa, but up twice. And I've done the south coast up and down probably three or four times, different ways.
Yes.
Been through Victoria, did the coast a couple of times, up through the mountains. I always try, if I go the coast going to a certain place, then I'll go up through the mountains.
Okay.
When I'm coming back. I was in South Australia when COVID hit, so I was on the Mornington Peninsula.
Hey, so were we. We were in South Oz.
Yeah. And I was on my way to Western Australia to start doing, like, the big loop.
Okay.
And, of course, I had to come back. I had to come back into country New South Wales.
I understand.
Which
we did
I
the
did.
Same, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bit of a painful experience because we were in South Oz too, and we had to cut our trip short. Now, you are set up for free camping. You've got a fridge, you've got batteries, you've got solar panels. So do you normally stay free camping, or do you prefer caravan parks? What's your sort of ratio of free to caravan parks, or what do you do? Where do you mainly stay?
I mainly free camp.
Okay.
I very rarely will go into a caravan park.
Okay.
Maybe if I've once a fortnight or once every 3 weeks if I need to do some washing.
Okay.
But I normally free camp. I love being out on the road, and I like all those little towns. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that I try and do is, you know, support the little towns and their communities.
Yes.
So a lot of the, like the pubs and the golf clubs and that, you can stay there overnight for free.
Okay.
And you just go in and have a meal, you know. So you're sort of supporting the community,
exactly.
Which I think is really important.
Yes.
But I also love farm stays. So I'd probably do, you know, 5% caravan parks, another, you know, sort of 50% free camp, and the rest I do farm stays. Yeah.
Now, as a woman, and you've been travelling now solo for 3 years, how do you feel on the road? Do you feel safe at some of these places? Or tell us about your experiences. When you get there, you set up, how do you decide what you're going to do and how long you're going to stay?
Yeah, I've always felt safe. I think the first couple of weeks when I was first taking off,
yeah,
it took me a little while to find my foot and you know, go, okay, I'm all right.
Okay.
But I did a lot of research beforehand, and, you know, the rules, I suppose, are I always have the van parked so that I can escape if I need to.
Right.
I never, set up anything until I sort of see who's coming. And if I'm not feeling 100%, you've got to go on your gut feeling about it.
Yep, yes.
Then I'll move on.
Okay.
But, you know, most of the time, you know, I think I've only ever once sort of thought, oh, no, you know, I'm going to keep going. But I never leave my awning up at night.
Okay.
I did have a double seat in the front, which I took out and put a single seat in, so I can go from the back to the front without having to climb over anything.
Okay.
So, you know, having all of those. And, of course, you know, I have a GPS spot device.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because, like you said, you had a couple of boys. One of the boys has helped you set the truck up. How do they feel about you travelling alone on the road? Do they worry about you? Because you've mentioned the spot device. Now, was that something your boys encouraged you to get, or was that something you just thought, oh, I'm just going to have that just for, yeah, in case?
I guess my boys were a bit anxious in the beginning.
Right.
But the reason why I got the spot device is because my niece is a police officer, and she does a lot of hiking and stuff.
Okay.
And she was the one who suggested that I get it.
So just explain to the listeners, what is a spot device for anybody that's never even heard of it? What does a spot device do?
Okay, it's a GPS tracker.
Right.
And so, you know, it's a satellite device.
Uh-huh.
So it doesn't, like, if I don't have phone reception, I can still depend on it being able to get through.
Right.
You can set it up. I've got it set up so that I can send a message to both of my sons, my brother and my niece,
right,
saying, and my message simply says, I'm awesome.
Okay.
You know, and they know then that I'm fine.
You're happy and safe.
And
yep.
I'm safe.
Yes.
It also, if there's a little, like, footprint, and so if I press that, it then finds my coordinates.
Yes.
And it goes through, and my boys can, they've both got the app on their phone, so they can go and they can see where I am.
Okay.
And because it sits just behind my head, I will just, as I'm driving, I will just drop little footprints every, you know, say hour to 2 hours, depending where I am.
Okay.
So that they can go on the device, on the app, anytime.
Uh-huh.
And know exactly where I am.
Okay.
And know that I'm still moving and I'm all good.
Fantastic. Now, it's not a very expensive device, is it, really?
No, I think I paid probably about $120 for it.
Okay.
And I paid $24 a month. $24 a month.
Right.
I suppose it's just like a mobile phone, isn't it?
Okay.
But it just gives everybody peace of mind.
Okay.
And if I was ever really in trouble, there's a button that goes straight through to emergency services,
okay,
and gives them precisely where I am.
Okay. So is, I guess if for a boatie, it'd be equivalent to an EPIRB, where if you're stuck in the ocean, or if you're broken down, or if you're stranded or abandoned out in the middle of nowhere, you can actually press this device.
Yep.
It'll go to the satellite, and if they can't find you or contact you via normal communication, they will assume something's wrong here and come and look for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's a great piece of equipment to have. Actually, I think I should possibly consider getting one of those myself, actually. All right. Well, Diane, thank you so much for taking some time to chat with us. It's been absolutely wonderful to speak to a lady traveller by herself, because we have chatted to lots of different people. And, of course, it's always great to be able to find a female that's travelling alone and find out your experiences. So I'm gonna play you a song now for taking the time to chat with us, and it does have to be Aussie. Do you have an actual favourite Australian singer or band or something like that that you might like to have us play for you?
Well, I love Slim Dusty.
Okay.
And I've got to say, out of all the Australian songs, I love Waltzing Matilda.
Waltzing Matilda by Slim Dusty.
Yeah.
All right, Diane. Well, we're going to put that up for you straight away now. And thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. All right, listeners, now stick around for Slim Dusty's Waltzing Matilda. And straight after that, we will be back with more Roman Oz.
Once a jolly swagman camped by a billabong under the shade of a coolabah tree. He sang as he watched and waited till his billy boiled. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. He sang as he watched and waited till his billy boiled. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Down came a jumbuck to drink at the billabong. Up jumped the swagman and grabbed him with glee. He sang as he shoved that jumbuck in his tucker bag. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. He sang as he shoved that jumbuck in his tucker bag. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Up rode the squatter, mounted on his thoroughbred. Up rode the troopers, 1, 2, 3. with the jolly jumbuck that you got in your tucker bag. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. With the jolly jumbuck that you got in your tucker bag, you'll come a waltzing, you scoundrel, with me. Up jumped a swagman, sprang into the billabong. You'll never take me alive, said he, and his ghost may be heard as you pass by that billabong. You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. His ghost may be heard as you pass by that billabong. You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with everybody. Waltzing Matilda, as you pass by that billabong, you'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me.
Glenn, I'm actually going to be chatting to Alan. Now, Alan's a volunteer there, and he sells some items about those particular paintings that they've done there on the silo there at Goorambat. Now, do you know much about those ones or not?
Yes, I do, Phil. The Goorambat community is very proud to have Jimmy DeVate's artwork adorn the silos. Jimmy is passionate about conservation and is particularly keen to highlight the plight of endangered species. The barking owl is the most threatened owl in Victoria, with northeast Victoria a remaining stronghold for wild populations.
Well, I'm pretty excited now, Lynn. I've got to tell you, I'm just going to chuff off now down to Goorambat and catch up with Alan Saunders himself.
Alan, can you tell us all about these wonderful silo arches? There's three of them here in Goorambat. Now, I understand there's two on the back of where we are, one of an owl and one of a palm scene. Now, they were painted when?
They were painted in Easter 2018.
Okay. And how long would it have took the artist to paint them?
It took 2 weeks to paint the one on the Clydesdales. I presume it was the same as the other two. It would be about 6 weeks' work.
About 6 weeks' work?
Yes, yeah, so and they cost $10,000 each.
$10,000 each. Wow. And you said it took about 6 weeks to paint the three of them. Now, who've actually painted these ones here in Goorambat? Because with the solo art, they're all over the country now, and lots of different artists. Who's responsible for these particular three?
These three were painted by Jimmy DeVate.
Okay.
He lives in Richmond, Melbourne.
Okay.
The committee formed here when they talked about solo art,
mm-hmm.
and they formed Goorambat Community Incorporated.
Right.
And I'm not on the committee, but the committee decided they would have to have local something. So the horses were bred here in Goorambat.
Okay.
And but they're not here now. They're actually up at Toowoomba. They've sold them out. These horses here, the Laverine Stud it's called.
Right.
And that is the oldest registered Clydesdale stud in Australia.
Okay.
I think it's about 102-year-old.
Right.
And they come from Laverine, the original the people, and they settled here in Goorambat. And they started this stud. And that was the first generation. And the next generation, Tom Troon, who was the local member of Parliament, married their granddaughter.
Mm-hmm.
And his sons actually reared these horses that are on here now.
Fantastic. So how old those horses are still alive?
Yes, the one on the right.
Right.
That's the stallion they're using now for breeding purposes in Queensland.
Mm-hmm. And how old were the horses being, approximately?
Oh, I couldn't. They're beyond the board. I just don't know offhand.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll have a look at that after, because there's lots of information, listeners.
Yep.
If you do come out to Goorambat, the solo art, There's lots of information out here. And as Alan was saying, it took about 6 weeks to paint the three of them. And I understand he's coming back to do another one. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe they've got him engaged to come back in June.
Right. He was of this year, 21?
Yeah, 21. He was doing it March last year, but the COVID, they stopped it in his tracks. But he's booked up to come here in June, and he's going to paint another one on the door of the oat pool shed, which is down the other end.
So have you got any idea what he's going to paint?
I've got no idea.
Oh, okay. So we can't... It's not a scoop, Alan. We can't tell our listeners in advance.
I'm not on the committee and they won't tell me. I'm dying to find out.
I can understand why they wouldn't tell you, because this could be a scoop. I could have told my listeners well in advance. Yeah. But it's definitely going to be done sometime in June. Is that correct?
That's right. That is right.
Okay. All right. Well, we're just going to have to keep our fingers crossed, I think, Alan. What do you think?
I think so.
Now, just tell us a little bit about yourself, Alan, also. Now, I understand you're 90 years young.
Oh, that's right.
And you're a local here.
That's right.
Born and bred.
My great-grandfather came out from England in 1842. He was three and a half.
Okay.
And when he was, when they just subdivided the land north of divided all Crown land, they wrote with a settlement. And all those early settlers pegged out their claims, and £1 an acre was the cost.
Okay.
And I've got a copy of the release of Crown land signed by Queen Victoria.
Okay.
So in that was in 1872 he
right.
came here.
Okay.
He had a family of nine children.
Right.
He also selected one at Admiral. And also another one out on the Arawaka Road. So okay. He selected three places.
Right.
He had six sons and three daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And he put two sons on each place. And the three daughters, when they got married, he paid them out in cash.
Right.
They paid their own way out from England. They didn't come as convicts.
Yes. Okay.
So, and they settled in Melbourne. And they bought property just near the Moreland Station. There was several hundred acres they bought.
Right.
Worth millions and millions today.
Of course.
They sold it and bought a farm at Mickleham.
Okay.
And that's where they got established. But they all spread out from there. But William Thornton, my great-grandfather, he came here in 1872.
Okay.
And my grandparents took over that property in 1900 when they got married.
Right.
And then my parents took that farm over in 1926 when they got married.
Yes.
Dad retired in 1974 and farm come down to my brother Les and I, and Les wanted to retire in 2000, so I brought him out.
Right.
So I've got the original holding that he selected.
So you call yourself a local?
Yeah, I'm a local. That one's true. I went to school here. I left school, I worked in a general store.
Yes.
And then when I got married, I bought the Burrabut Post Office.
Okay.
Had our family there.
Uh-huh.
And then for about 20 years I went to Melbourne. I was a postmaster down there.
Okay.
And then we come back here to live permanently.
Okay. So you're definitely a local. Are you here every day, Alan?
No, not every day.
Not every day? So how often are you here, Alan?
Well, before COVID, I come here 9 months for about 3 days a week, because in windy days and wet days I can't come.
Yeah,
or 6 days.
Yep.
So for 9 months, I sold $31,000 worth of
merchandise. And the merchandise is fantastic. Just to let you know, listeners, he's got things like stubby holders and coffee mugs and fridge magnets. And what else have you got, Alan? Tell us about some of your goodies here. And it's all to do with the solo art.
Everything we've got here has got solo art things on it.
Yep.
We also got tea towels, aprons and shopping bags. All our work is done up at Mansfield. We work to keep it locally.
Yes.
Yeah,
so it's all local stuff by local people, and we're talking about local art.
Yes, Gurumbat was a thriving little town when I was a boy.
Right.
Because we had two general stores and a bakery and everything going. Everybody shopped locally. But supermarkets have ruined all these little towns, and they're all feeling the pinch.
Yeah.
Most little towns are sort of becoming ghost towns.
Yes.
This was until the silo art. Now it's a little tourist town.
Now it's a tourist town. And the population of Gurumbat, that's, what, 100 and something people?
About 120 or 30.
Something. About 120 or 30. So it's a small town. Thanks to the silo art and the tourists, it's kind of holding its own now.
Yes,
it's doing all right again.
It's going to thrive now, because we had a... a cafe just opened up at Christmas time, and I never thought in my wildest dream I'd ever see a cafe in Gurumbat.
Okay, but it's opened.
And it's run by the Veterans Retreat,
right?
Which is a they bought the local school when it closed down, and it's there for any serviceman can come and have a break, bring their car out and stay, or they're going to put cabins there.
Yep.
And just a dental, and the profits of this goes toward maintaining the. That program.
Fantastic.
So that's been a great thing for Gurumbat. And another thing, we're hoping to have a solar farm built next year, just here.
Okay.
And they've contributed also, we've got a check from last month for $10,000.
Right.
And we already bought a barbecue, and the rest we're going to put in children's playground equipment in the Victory Park next to the hall.
Next to the hall. Great stuff. All right, Alan, well, I've got to finish up now. Have you got a favourite singer you'd like me to... I'm going to play a song for you. Have you got a favourite singer at all, Alan? It's got to be Australian.
Oh, I think I've got every one of Slim Dusty's CDs.
Okay. Slim's great. What about a favourite Slim song then?
I always like When the Rain Comes Down in July, one of his early songs.
When the Rain Comes Down?
When the Rain Tumbles Down in July.
When the Rain Tumbles Down in July. Slim Dusty, I'm going to put it straight on now, listeners. Stick around for that, and we'll be back with more Roman Oz straight after that.
Let me wander north to the homestead, way out further on there to roam. By a gully in flood, let me linger when the summery sunshine has flown. Where the logs tangle up on the creek bed and clouds veil the old northern sky, and the cattle move back from the lowlands when the rain tumbles down in July. The settlers with sad hearts are watching the rise of the stream from the dawn. Their best crops are always in flood reach. If it rises much more, they'll be gone. The cattle string out long the fences. The wind from the south races by, and the limbs from the old gums are fallen when the rain tumbles down in July. The sleeping gums on the hillside awaken to herd straying by, from the flats where the fences have vanished as the storm clouds gather on high. The wheels of the wagon stop turning, the stock horses turned out to stray, the old station dogs are a-dozing on the husks in the barn through the day. The drover draws rein by the river, it's years since he's seen it so high. Yes, and that's just the story of Homewood when the rain tumbles down in July.
Oh, what a great song, Lynn, by Slim Dusty, When the Rain Tumbles Down in July.
Yes, Slim is very popular with our interviewees, isn't he?
Oh, the country regional listeners love the Slim.
And so where are we off to now, Phil?
Oh, Lynn, I've got a surprise for you. Remember right at the start of the program, I said I was going to send you off to Stanton Killeen?
Yes, that's right.
Stanton Killeen. Now, what's Stanton Killeen all about?
Ah, well, it's a winery in the Rutherglen region.
Absolutely. And you know what I've managed to do?
Yes.
I've managed to organise a chat with you and Wendy Killeen from Stanton Killeen.
Okay, well, I better get that started.
That sounds good to me, Lynn.
We are visiting Stanton and Colleen, a winery in Rother Glen, which is in northeast Victoria, and we're with Wendy, the owner. How are you today, Wendy?
I'm very well, thank you, Lynn.
That's good. Now, for our listeners, when did Stanton and Colleen all begin?
We first planted grapes in 1875.
Yes.
And so that makes us 146 years old.
Wow.
And another exciting fact about our company at the moment is our oldest vineyard turns 100 this year.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And I believe that's seven generations of the family.
My daughter is the seventh generation of our family. We're Killeens, and the original owners were Stantons. And back in 1948, a Stanton married a Killeen. So we've enjoyed continuous family business since 1875.
And what, all the, everyone has sort of been a vineyard?
Yes. We've made wine since 1875, and people say, well, how can you be so old in Australia? Yeah. I mean, we're not that old as a modern nation, and it's because the wine industry is very male-dominated, or has been for many generations, not so much now, but I guess in the early days, I suppose in the first four or five generations, the wineries, the business was left to the son, the oldest son.
Yep.
So that's why we're here in business today. My daughter is in her early 30s, and we run the business together now. Mm-hmm. It's the first time in the family's history that women have been in charge. Yes.
Oh, wow, that's exciting. It's good to see.
Yes.
It's very good to see. And so what, she studied winemaking, or is she just picked it up
No, we're more business owners, managers.
Yep. Right,
we employ winemakers and vineyard managers, and we're a team of 10. We're really the owners, but we're learning. It's been in our family all these years, and we've picked it up over the years, but we're certainly not technically trained.
Right, okay. So you have award-winning Tokays and Muscats.
Yes.
And
Port.
And Port.
We're very lucky here in Rother Glen because we have a warm climate, and we're able to grow many different grapes.
Yep.
So in our vineyard alone, we have 14 different varieties. Mm-hmm. So we make sparkling wine, we make white wine, we make red wine, and we make fortified wine, which of course is the Muscats, Tokays, which we now call Topaque, and Port.
Yes. Oh, lovely. And I did notice when I was doing a little bit of research, you do a white port.
We do. We do. And of course, white port is very traditional in Portugal.
Yes.
And our point of difference in the wine industry in Rother Glen is we have a number of Portuguese port varieties.
Yes.
We planted those in the late 1980s, early 90s to make vintage port. And after Chris's death in 2007, we decided to honour him by making a table wine, first time ever, with the Portuguese port varieties.
Oh.
And since then, we now make six different table wines with the beautiful port varieties.
Oh, that would be nice.
And they're lovely. So we make from sparkling Tempranillo, which in our vineyard it's called Tinto Roriz, which is Portuguese.
Yep.
We make rosé, we make a number of different reds and port.
Oh, lovely. Mm. Okay, and also you have a barrel club. What is that, and what do you need to do?
Okay.
It sounds interesting.
Well, in our cellar out the back here where we're sitting today, we have more than 500,000 litres of fortified wine maturing in barrels and casks. And, and we make a lot of blending port, musket and topaque, and we sell a lot of personalised barrels, so people can come in here and buy handmade 5-litre, 10-litre, 15-litre or 20-litre barrels, and we supply the wine.
Oh,
and when you buy that barrel, you join our club. It's free, and we help you through your port or your barrel journey. Each year you can bring a sample back and we can test it for you, make sure that it's all fresh, and you can top up, and we support you with your beautiful barrel for a number of years.
Oh, so you take your barrel home with you.
You take your barrel home.
Right.
Because in this day and age, people have everything. A lot of people have everything. And we find that people love these port barrels, or they're fortified wine barrels, because it's something that grows with you, and the wine matures over years, and you can top up.
Yes,
and it's a point of difference at home too.
Yes, I remember my first experience with a wine barrel. Didn't realise that you had to pour water in it to make it stretch, and of course, you know, everything just went through.
We actually season them. So when you buy a barrel from us, they've been seasoned and tightened, and you know, all the wood characters leached out.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Now, you do cellar doors?
We have a beautiful cellar door, yes, and we have a very busy cellar door because Rutherglen is quite a tourist destination.
Yes.
A lot of wine tourism here. There's over 20, just over 20 wineries in Rutherglen, and there are 19 members of the winemakers of Rutherglen, and there are some smaller independent wineries that we support as well.
Oh, okay.
We do have a cellar door, yes.
Yes.
And we have a number of wines on tasting, and we have very friendly staff, and we have a beautiful ground surrounding our cellar door.
Yes, no, it's a lovely area.
So it's a great place to come and have a picnic or come and taste wine, and we do tours as well.
And you do tours. Okay, and your hours of operation?
Hours of operation, well, of course, it's we're sort of back to normal. We were shut, and then we had limited hours when we originally opened after COVID lockdown.
Yeah.
Our hours are 9 till 5 each day, Sundays at 10 till 5.
Wow, so you can come here for a nice afternoon sitting out in this beautiful greenery and ground. And do you do platters or anything?
Yes, tasting platters? Yes, we do. We do either build your own platter or we order beautiful platters from a terrific chef in Rutherglen called Kate, who owns Savoy Truffle.
And
she's actually catering today for us for Taste of Rutherglen.
Right, and what's Taste of Rutherglen?
Taste of Rutherglen is a Winemakers of Rutherglen initiative that started many, many years ago. Always held on the March Victorian Long Weekend, March Long Weekend. And it's a showcase of food and wine matching.
Lovely.
And everybody's got music, all the wineries have music, and we have food, and we here at Stanton and Killeen we have games for the children.
Yes.
We have music. There's bean bags to lounge around on the lawn.
Wonderful. And so you're expecting a huge crowd.
Yes, we are. Yes? We're hoping.
Oh, very good. Okay, well, that sounds like an exciting place to visit. And to end off the interview, what song, Aussie song, would you like to hear?
Well, the first Aussie song that has popped into my head is Men at Work, Land Down Under.
Oh,
Land
okay.
Down Under.
Wonderful.
Heard it on the radio the other day.
Okay,
so
we
Australian.
We should have that song, Phil?
Definitely, most definitely. We've got that. We've got all the Australian songs, you know that. And it is a popular song.
Yes.
Thank you so much for selecting that, Wendy. That's going to be great.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yes.
Thank you. Oh, thank you for the opportunity.
No.
And we welcome anybody to our cellar door.
Yes.
Wonderful. Is there a charge for the cellar door, incidentally, or not?
Yes. We've introduced, most of the wineries in Victoria now have introduced a tasting fee.
Okay.
So in the past it's been free.
Logical.
But we certainly have only recently introduced a tasting fee, which is only sensible, really.
Absolutely. Yes. No, I can understand that.
No, I can too. Well, wonderful. Well, let's get this song underway. And thank you so much again, Wendy, for your time.
Welcome. Thank
and let's hope Taste of Rutherglen goes really well.
Thank you very much.
Stick around, listeners. Men at Work, Land Down Under, and we'll be back with more Roaming Oz straight after that.
Fantastic song selection there from Wendy Killeen at Stan Killeen Winery. Men at Work's Down Under. What a great song. Now, listeners, stick around. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the mighty Murray, okay? I'm going to give you some history on the Murray River. And it all began about 40 million years ago. Now, this was through the forces of water and geological uplifting. The valley that cradles Australia's greatest river began to take shape. The Murray is a river whose character encompasses environmental beauty. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's rich in heritage and history, and there's busy townships along there and amazing regional centres as well. Now, with the amazing tourism experience and a world-class agricultural food and wine region, definitely places there not to be missed, listeners. Now, it creates a border between New South Wales and Victoria, and it's the world's, well, it's rates in about the, I think, the 16th longest river, okay? Now, it's over 2,500 kilometres. It's huge. Now, it's a bed for several rivers, including the Darling and the Murrumbidgee, of course, which is on its journey from the Australian Alps before flowing through South Australia to the Southern Ocean. Now, it sits in the Murray-Darling Basin, draining most of inland Victoria and New South Wales and, of course, southern Queensland from the western side of the Great Dividing Range. Now, it was first discovered by a couple of European travellers, explorers, if you like. No, and they weren't backpackers. Hume and Hovell. Now, back in the 1800s, 1824, I think it was. Now, it wasn't until 5 years later, however, that Charles Sturt navigated down the Murrumbidgee to encounter the Murray and named it after Sir George Murray. Now, when his exploration party encountered the Darling Connection. Now, you imagine back in the 1800s, the Murray River would have been like a superhighway. Paddle steamers were used, okay? They used to carry wool and wheat and other goods up and down the river system, including the Murray-Darling, Murrumbidgee rivers. Now, since settlement of the river basin was so late, the introduction of the railroad came much sooner to the river towns, and it had a large impact on the steamers along the Murray. Irrigation was introduced in 1887 by Canadian George Chaffee around Mildura in Victoria and Renmark, South Australia. Now, this greatly accelerated the settlement and exploitation of the river's water supply. In 1918, a commission was formed to manage water supply, and it also coordinated the construction of storage locks and weirs to reduce the effects of drought and flood. Today, the water flow is still managed by these locks on the river from Yarrawonga in Victoria to Blanchetown, Lock Number 1 in South Australia. Millions of people rely on the Murray as a source of water for domestic and industrial use, and it plays a significant part in Australia's economy. A large range amount of species can be found living on the river and around the river basin, including emus, koalas, western grey kangaroos, bearded dragon lizards, red-rumped parrots, black swans, pelicans, and even dolphins, listeners, yes, even dolphins, closer to the ocean. Also plentiful of fish such as Murray cod, bream, perch, and that pesky introduced species which they call redfin, which, of course, if you catch a redfin, it's illegal to put it back in the water. Redfin are an English perch that was introduced, and they're such a pest, like the European carp. If you catch any of those ones, you got to either hit them over the head with something and feed them to the pelicans or whatever else is flying about, or just throw them in your campfire. Don't put them back in the river because they really are a nuisance. Well, there you go, listeners. I hope you found some of that information interesting. I know I did. 2,500 kilometres long, one of the 16th longest rivers in the world. And there's something else I'm going to make mention of that you may not be aware of, and that is the story of the Murray River flag. Now, it's one of the oldest flags in Australia, okay? Now, this came about before Federation. The Australian colonies used to fly the Union Jack from the United Kingdom. Now, however, back in the 1850s, I think it was, you know, our sense of national pride emerged. Yes, it did indeed. And varied unofficial flags often featured the Southern Cross constellation and were designed and flown. Now, the Murray River flag first appeared at Goolwa to honour the first paddle steamer on the Murray River, the Mary Ann, on the barge Eureka. Now, it's the only flag in the world named in honour of the river. The flag was described, and it was also reported of the Australian Register, as the flag bears the red cross with the four horizontal blue bars. Now, the cross being charged with five stars as emblems of the colonies, while the upper corner is taken up with the British connection, which was, I guess, depicted by the Union Jack. Now, it has often been named, we understand, the Murray River flag, and has been said that the blue bars represent the four major rivers that run into the Murray River, which, of course, is the Murrumbidgee, the Lachlan, and the Darling. Now, the lower Murray flags, used predominantly in South Australia, is designed by the use of the pale blue bands, which, of course, represent the lighter coloured water of the lower reaches of the Murray. And the upper Murray flag has the darker blue bands on its flag. And that, of course, is representing the darker waters of the river's upper regions. Now, the designer was also the house flag of the Murray River Steam Navigation Co., which suggests that the lineal descendant of the original flag design. So no specimen, I must point out, no specimen of or fragment of the original Murray flag is known to exist today, as far as I'm concerned, or as far as I'm aware. Now, listeners, all this talk of flags and the mighty Murray and so on and so forth has inspired me to select a song for you, okay? And the one I'm going to put on for you right now is one made famous, of course, by Johnny Williamson, one of our great, great Australian country singers and conservationist. And the song I'm going to play for you is a number called A Flag of Our Own.
Ned Kelly came round to see me today. I guess I was dreaming, oh, dumbfounded, I couldn't think what to say. Oh, I beckoned him in, but he shook his head. He said, I'm a bit grubby and a bit poorly bred. I'd rather we yarned out the back in the shed. I can leave my boots on that way. Well, he took a stiff whiskey and laid down his gun. He said, I won't keep you long, 'cause I've got to run, got to ride to the mountains before night is done. He said, words got around about the music you play. You truly believe in the fair income way, that the bush must remain for our spirit to stay, and we must have a flag of our own. Said I learned long ago, when I was still young, like the lizard that spits and sticks out his tongue, oh, the way to get shot is to carry a gun. Oh, there's a new world order, the leaders all shout, and everyone's frantic, they're gonna miss out. And the red, white and blues are still marching about. Oh, we must have a flag of our own. Australia, and that's where we're from. We're not Yankee sidekicks or second-class pawns. And tell the frogs what they can do with their bomb. And we must have a flag of our own. Yeah, this is Australia, and that's where we're from. We're not Yankee sidekicks or second-class pawns. And tell the frogs what they can do. We must have a flag of our own.
Gee, that John Williamson, he amazes me. He can write a song about anything.
As long as it's Australian though, Lynn.
Yes, that's correct, Phil.
All right, listeners, so don't forget, we'll be back next week with more
Roman Oz. We hope you enjoyed the show, listeners.
If you missed any, check out our Facebook page, Spotify, or romanoz.com.au.
Tune in next week for more
Roman Oz.